Every true artist does feel, consciously or unconsciously, that he is touching transcendental truths, that his images are shadows of things seen through the veil. The natural mystic does know that there is something there, behind the clouds or within the trees, but he believes that the pursuit of beauty is the way to find it, that imagination is a sort of incantation that can call it up. We know the meaning of all myths. We know the last secret revealed to the perfect initiate, and it is not the voice of a priest or a prophet saying, "There, things are." It is the voice of a dreamer and an idealist crying, "Why cannot these things be?" Welcome to Pints with Chesterton, a podcast where two millennial women dive into the wonderful and whimsical works of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. I'm Marie.
And I'm Grace. On today's episode, we are discussing Chapter 5 of The Everlasting Man, Man and Mythologies. Marie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Happy Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day.
This is releasing a few days later, but this is when we're recording it. What, did you have a nice day today?
I did, yeah. My mom came into town, which is fun. She hasn't been in a town for a long time. And so I got to see her and hang out with some friends, have a little cookout. Yeah, it was
That's
good.
That's so nice.
So how about you?
Yeah, it was really good. We took our kids to Rochester. There's a local zoo there, and Alexander had a fantastic time. We had a fantastic time, and we had lunch, a picnic lunch out there, and we got to go to Trader Joe's, which was the highlight for me because I only get to go there like 4 times a year. So,
oh my gosh, I love Trader Joe's. I shop there all the time.
I know. I'm like, San Diego has a ton of Trader Joe's, so I grew up going to Trader Joe's, but it was great. I stocked up on all my favorites, and we had a lovely day, and then came home and just had a quiet rest of the day, which was also nice. It's been kind of like rainy on and off here, so we had a cozy afternoon inside.
That's nice. It was the first day here where it was unbearably hot outside. It was like probably only, I don't know, like 95 by temperature, but it was one of those feels like 105 days, you know? So it was rough.
Our hottest, like extreme freak weeks of the year are 95 degrees. That's like maybe in the
summer. It's like early summer for us right now, unfortunately.
That's crazy. Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people think they can't handle the winter up here, and that's fair. But
the summers are lovely.
Yeah, the spring, summer, and fall, it's like, you know, in the spring, 60 degrees. And then, it just is lovely. It's really nice. Yeah, and I'm drinking port tonight.
Nice. Fancy. Yeah. I'm having water again, because again, it's like 105 outside. And also, I only have this next episode, I'll be able to have another pint. So
perfect.
It's almost the end of May.
Oh, a cold beer will be good on 95 degree day.
Yes, it will.
It'll be so good. In this chapter, this is chapter 5, as we've said, Chesterton addresses mythologies, what they're meant to mean, how people react to them, how are we meant to take them, and how does it relate to Christianity?
I think that this understanding is so lost on people today, and just in general. And I found even teaching scripture and stuff over the last couple of years, like trying to explain Genesis to people, especially the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and trying to get them to understand that, it's something very, well, first of all, it's just something very unique, which Chesterton is going to kind of talk about, not Genesis specifically, but just Christianity in general, as something altogether different. But understanding the idea of myth, as he describes it in this chapter, I think would really help people to understand what's going on there. That's what I was thinking about reading this. But But yeah, I just think we're so over like scientific in the way we think about things that it's yes. hard for us, I think, sometimes to be poetical without just yes. like pulling it apart like scientists, like he was kind of talking yes. about. So I just think it's sort of a lost art, no pun intended.
Which he says.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, anyway, I really enjoy this chapter. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, he talks about myths being a lost art. And that was my first question, actually, was what does he say myths are and how can we sort of understand that? One thing he mentions is that a myth is an ache for something.
Mm, yeah.
What did you think about that?
I love that. I was trying to find another quote. He says, ignorant as a child is, he knows more than he can say and feels not only atmospheres, but fine shades. And he says, the ache of the artist to find some sense in some story in the beautiful things he sees, his hunger for secrets and his anger at any tower or tree escaping with its tale untold. He feels that nothing is perfect unless it is personal. And I think it's like, this whole idea of atmospheres and fine shades, like there's something that we're like, we can look at the things around us and we can look at a story even, and we can think like, oh, like there's something that this is getting at that I can feel that's like a deep truth and it's like a reality, but I like don't know how to like express it, I guess, scientifically, so you express it artistically instead, and it's like
experientially,
and it's never, the art is never, and the myth is never meant to be scientific truth. It's never meant to be like oh, this is explaining things exactly or whatever, but it's trying to get at something. It's trying to like make you feel a reality. So I think the whole importance of myths that I think people in our culture are not trained to understand these days is that a story can be true even if it's not literal or scientific, or it can be talking about something that's real without it being scientifically factual. So yeah, like, and kind of parsing that apart is difficult, I think.
Totally. In this chapter, he says, behind all these things is the fact that beauty and terror are very real things and related to a real spiritual world, and to touch them at all, even in doubt or fancy, is to stir the deep things of the soul.
Yes, yes.
And to comment on what you said, he's saying you can't analyze this art scientifically. It actually ruins it to pick it apart, which is why he gives the examples that he does of like the skylark and the poetry, I think Shelley, and the poetry about the skylark and all of the things he's comparing the skylark to that are nothing like a skylark, but nobody's bothered by that because he's trying to express something and he's making a connection that goes beyond just dictionary definitions.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? It's like a whole, like I said, feeling our atmosphere. It's like something that goes much deeper than you can express, even just in words. I really like also the quote that you read at the beginning of this episode about the artist, that every true artist does feel consciously or unconsciously that he is touching transcendental truths. The natural mystic does know that there is something there, something behind the clouds or within the trees. Yeah. So it's like it's gesturing towards something that is a reality that's much deeper than we can express.
When I started reading this chapter, I was hearing echoes of Lewis as I kind of started to mention Lewis at the end of the last chapter. And then in talking to David about this book, he said, oh, Lewis practically stole everything from this book for Mere Christianity.
Yeah.
So, but he talks about his conversion in one of his letters.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, was the whole myths thing.
Yeah. And he, you know, went from, I don't know, agnostic to believing in some sort of higher power to becoming a theist, and in conversations with Tolkien and Dyson, and they convince him of the fact that the one true myth is the story of Jesus Christ, the myth of Jesus Christ. And I just want to read a little bit of his letter to, it's to Arthur Greaves. He's talking about this interaction he had because I think this is so beautiful. He says, "The reason was that in pagan stories, I was prepared to feel the myth as profound and suggestive of meanings beyond my grasp, even though I could not say in cold prose what it meant. Now, the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this tremendous difference that it really happened, and one must be content to accept it in the same way, remembering that it is God's myth, where the others are men's myths, i.e. the pagan stories are God expressing himself through the minds of poets, using such images as he found there, while Christianity is God expressing himself through what we call real things."
Yeah, it makes it's so me think. Good. Yeah, it's so good, and it makes me think of the end of this chapter when he says he's talking about myths, and then he's talking about Christianity, and he's talking about how these are like categorically different things. That's his point. Yes. In talking about this, like comparative religions and all this stuff from the last chapter, he's kind of continuing this by talking about the gods. Last chapter we talked about God, the concept of God, and how this is categorically different, and that these myths are like shadows, he says. He says these things were something like the real thing, these old myths, these pagan mythologies. And to say that they were like it is to say that they were different, right? Saying something is like a dog is another way of saying that it is not a dog. But he talks about this, and he says on the next page, "They are only different because one is real and the other is not. I do not mean merely that I myself believe that one is true and the other is not. I mean that one was never meant to be true in the same sense as the other." And so yes, the myths, there's something like very different, but yet they're still echoing this like reality of something. They're just not quite on the mark, but they're like getting at it. And so then when Jesus comes along and this whole story, the actual story of creation and the universe and everything and human history is revealed through the lens of Christ, it's like, oh my gosh, yes, like all of this has been preparing, you know, for the reality, yes, for the real thing.
Yeah.
So I love that in Lewis.
Yeah. That is, it's amazing. I feel like my whole life too, I've been hearing, I don't know who said this to me, but that, you know, that God can bring something good out of anything, any situation. And, you know, it's mostly said as a comfort to people when they're going through something hard, like, well, God will bring something good out of the situation. But I really thought that as I was reading about pagans and their mythology and thinking that, I mean, not that mythology was bad, it was expressing something good, it was reaching at something good, but God uses it, you know, he uses it for his own will, his own purposes, so beautifully. And
I feel like almost C.S. Lewis is kind of like a person in the Areopagus listening to Saint Paul, you know. Chesterton talks about like how he's proclaiming to them the unknown God, you know, and he says, St. Paul said that the Greeks had one altar to an unknown God, but in truth, all their gods were unknown gods. Yeah. And the real break in history did come when St. Paul declared to them whom they had ignorantly worshipped. And I feel like Tolkien was sort of like that to Lewis a little bit when Lewis wasn't obviously a pagan per se, but he was loved mythology and thought that it was getting at something real, you know.
Well, and when he lost his faith as a child, he found mythology and it really spoke to him.
Yeah.
And it totally makes sense that mythology spoke to both of these authors, because look at their beautiful, artistic, poetic minds. And you said this in the last episode that Chesterton is not a...
he's not a theologian or a philosopher.
Yeah. And he's an artist. And so then we're receiving this book in a very particular way that, you know, a theologian wouldn't put it in this way, but that's why it's so valuable.
Yeah. And I don't mean that he wasn't actually like doing philosophy or theology. Like, he is in some way. But he's not trained. He's not acting out of like a trained, like,
he's not saying it like an academic would come here and write a paper about this. Like, he's being just so authentically himself.
Right.
Okay, so Chesterton says about myths that they're not more serious for being taken seriously. They have a sort of sincerity and a sort of insincerity. He says this in a couple places. He says they are only sincere, though, in the same sense as art, not sincere in the same sense as morality.
He talks about like different examples of that, too, which I remember being good. Yes. Like a child stepping on the cracks of a sidewalk or something, or stepping on every other stone pavement, like not being the same thing as like stepping on a dog's tail. They take both of those things seriously, but like in different ways. Like one is actually moral and one actually isn't.
Because with the crack, what is the crack? If you step on a crack, you'll break your mother's back or something like that. Yeah. But the boy knows that stepping on the crack does nothing, whereas stepping on a dog's tail hurts the dog.
Yeah. And yet kids will like be so like intense, like I cannot step on the crack. You know what I mean?
And a little competitive about it, if we're being honest. I remember having competitions about that. But my question here was, does Chesterton claim that myths are meant to be believed? And if not, do they satisfy any, like what needs do they satisfy? Because he's clearly claiming that they're important. Are we meant to believe myths? And if not, what purpose are they serving then?
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. I feel like in some sense he might say, yes, we are meant to believe myths, but not believe in the same way that we'd believe a creed, you know, like he talks about that kind of like expressing like the pagan religions aren't telling us to stand up on some day of the week and like recite like, well, I believe in Zeus or I believe in Odin or Jupiter, I believe in. Whereas we say, I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, you know, and so it's getting at a reality. So in that sense, I think he does want us to believe myths because myths speak of truths. But again, the truths that myths speak of are not so like concrete historical truths, like the truth of the gospel. But like things that are a little more, or maybe I guess I should say less tangible, or things that are, less precise.
So he says that myths satisfy real needs for people. And I thought that was, wow, what an interesting claim. And he says it satisfies the need for doing things at certain times, the need for having festivity and formality.
Yeah.
And then the need for sacrifice.
Yeah. And how interesting too that even if you think about today where we sort of live in the West in like a post-Christian culture and we're heading to, and actually there's like this resurgence of like some kind of paganism, you know, that people are into and stuff. But but even without that, even without like the very specific resurgence of paganism, people create their own rituals. Like even when they reject religion as such, like they will create their own rhythms and routines and festivals and solemnities and like all these different things, like to kind of fill the gap, you know, from
could be football, could be music, could be
or it could just be like, you know, secular holidays or different things that we celebrate in the calendar, you know, that aren't necessarily bad, right? But we have to, we are religious people by nature. So we have to create these things if we're not doing the thing, the real thing, you know?
Well, he says we're natural worshipers.
Yeah.
He says man finds it natural to worship even unnatural things. And I think that's absolutely true, that if you're not worshiping God, you're going to be worshiping something else. You know, not maybe not consciously.
Right. Yeah. Probably most of the time, not consciously.
Or choosing necessarily. But I thought it was interesting that he talks about this idea of particularly needing to do certain things at certain times. It's like, okay, we are creatures of habit and routine. He's saying like, we need to celebrate or remember things at certain dates. But then this, the second and third one, festivity and formality, where can we see that festivity and formality in Christianity? And then obviously sacrifice. It's like God's ultimate sacrifice for us. But what did you think of the festivity and formality bit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of just the liturgical calendar. So it kind of goes hand in hand. We have this kind of cycle of feasting and fasting, and we love to celebrate all kind of different things. I mean, we literally have a feast of the chair of St. Peter, yeah. you know, or like yeah. the dedication of a basilica, yeah. you know, or something. We like, we yeah. celebrate all kind of stuff, you know? And then we have all these like fast days and these fast seasons like Lent. Yeah. And, yeah, we will be very solemn about certain things, you know, yeah. In the liturgy
It's so yeah. cool to think about pagans being as, I don't know if cyclical is the word, but yeah. as like having that same need for the liturgical seasons as us, but it just being expressed in this different way.
Totally. Yeah. And there's a lot of kind of overlap that you can see on the exterior. And I think that's kind of one of the things, one of the points Chesterton was making, is that a lot of times these things that we put in the comparative religions chart, we put them all there in the same chart because on the outside they look very similar, maybe, you know, so you see maybe a pagan going to a temple and offering a sacrifice and worshiping a god, you know, and it looks very similar to like the sacrifice of the mass, for example.
Yeah.
But the whole thing is categorically different because, again, he's claiming that the pagan is like acting out of a sort of mythology where he kind of knows that it's not like really true on some level, but it yeah. is true on another level, but he can't really like, yeah, it's
can't
different.
Can't put his finger on why yeah. it feels vague and yeah.
Exactly. But then Christianity, it's like, in some sense, there is this great mystery, but in another sense, like we know exactly, like we believe that it actually is, you know, like the presence of yeah. the Lord, and it's not something that is, yeah, gesturing at something. It's like actually the thing itself.
Totally. When he points to the gods versus Christ and he mm-hmm. says that like the gods never changed the world, they just kept having their stories of like living and dying and almost enduring the world, but they never like in the stories he says it's never clear who's the villain and who's the hero and if the gods are doing anything for humanity, but then the God of the universe, like Jesus Christ, he comes to earth and he dies for us. It's kind of cool to think about the similarities between Christ's story and some of the pagan myths, as if some of the tellers of these stories, I don't even want to say authors, because he says they're like stories a traveler would tell himself.
Oh, yeah.
But that the tellers of these stories, like, they do have an inkling of some greater sacrificial thing that's going to happen. But you're right. They don't know what it is and they can't quite pin it down.
Yeah. It's like this whole, like, I don't know, almost gifts of like prophecy in some sense, but very vague and mysterious. And I was really struck in this. I think it was kind of near the end of the chapter where he kind of was talking about, like, for lack of a better phrase, the connectedness of all things. He was kind of saying how very deep things in our nature, some dim sense of the dependence of great things upon small, some dark suggestion that the things nearest to us stretch far beyond our power, some sacramental feeling of the magic in immaterial substances, and many more emotions past fading out, are in an idea like that of the external soul. But they're just, he's just talking about like how there's this reality in the myths, you know, like there's this thing that is reaching beyond what they can explain, but they're gesturing towards it. So like you're saying, there was this reality of like this ability of human beings to see almost like what God was going to do without being able to see what God was going to do. Mm. It was like he put that in our DNA or something, like to intuit that there was something beyond, you know, we're material and spiritual creatures. We're not just material. And he speaks, even we don't realize that it's him that's speaking. I think that's really cool.
Yes.
Earlier I read this quote, talking about the ache of the artist, and he says he feels that nothing is perfect unless it is personal, looking at every tree and every little sign and every little thing. And it's like, I so related to that. And I was like, I know I have this desire in my own life for like things to mean something and like moments and events and like, and only in Christ, like God he comes to us in such a personal way. And it's like all these things that our hearts have been like aching and longing for, this personal meaning, this deeper meaning that is not just like random, but like, and out there somewhere, but like personal for me, like is a reality. And that's revealed in Christ, that God is speaking to us through all of the trees and all of the rocks and all of the like stuff. It's like not it, but it's the same him behind all of it. You know, it's not all these different
gods.
Yeah. What did you think? Actually, I wanted to talk briefly about the idea he talks about things being like very local and very particular.
That was such a cool idea.
Yeah.
He says he's like, they're not just worshiping water. They're worshiping a particular river.
Yeah. It's something very like tangible and tactile and incarnational, like just in very specific. And then I loved where a little bit later on he says, as a matter of fact, the Catholic Church has taken over with uproarious success the whole of this popular business of giving people local legends and lighter ceremonial movements. Insofar as all this sort of paganism was innocent and in touch with nature, there is no reason why it should not be patronized by patron saints as much as by pagan gods. I thought that was really cool.
Like, bring in all the good. Bring it
on. Yeah. And so all these funny little stories. I was thinking actually when I was reading this about things like Irish folklore and like how Ireland is has been for a long time, I guess, a very Catholic country culturally, but yet they also have all this Celtic like fairy tales and stuff, and it's kind of all like mixed in together
and a little bit of superstition.
Totally. But there's like kind of a mixture of like of these things, and some of it very innocent, you know, and it can kind of actually find its fulfillment in the Catholic faith. But I think that's really cool. I've always really loved that about Catholicism, that like in all of these different places of the world, there's these local myths and legends and things that get kind of taken up into the Catholic faith and take on like a more meaningful character, I guess. I like that he said the innocent parts of paganism, because I think sometimes we can think of it as all bad, you know?
Yes. And all dark and all like bloody, sacrificial, like
icky and scary. Yeah. And some of it was for sure, but
Not all. I do love that. I even had a conversation pretty recently with this couple that is probably going to move to La Crosse, which is awesome. They stayed with us and checked it out. But they're converts from Protestantism, basically Calvinism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the husband was saying, when I became Catholic, because they converted to Catholicism last year, when I became Catholic, I didn't want to leave all of the good parts of me behind that I felt like were, and I'm putting this in quotes, like Protestant, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, why would you? That's your experience. That's made you who you are today. And also, Protestants do some things a lot better than Catholics. They evangelize a lot better than we do. They're much more well-read with scripture. There are a number of things that I could say about that.
Culturally speaking, that could be helpful.
But it applies to the pagans, but it also applies to like people who become Catholics, but they don't want to leave, you know, all of the, I don't know, the charisms of their previous denomination behind, because there are some really beautiful and good things there that, you know, built up their faith.
Yeah. Well, and especially our fellow Christians, you know, like brothers and sisters in Christ, that like we do have a common heritage. And so just because we were split, you know what I mean? Like there's still these realities of these, like you said, charisms from baptism, you know, that people receive. And it's like the church needs to be together. Like we need to get the band back together, you know? So it makes sense. To hold on to all of those things and to bring them together rather than kind of categorizing them.
We're this big, diverse family anyway. Like that is why we have so many rites in the Catholic Church, which are not different churches, but just different expressions of liturgy. Because though the Mass is the same all over the world, it also, the music and the some of the order of things and some of the prayers and expressions are just different, because they were developed in different cultures and different areas. And that's really beautiful. Like God doesn't, he didn't create us to be all the same. He wants us to use our particular good desires and talents and all of that to worship him in the way that he's calling us to.
Right.
Oh, I want to read, because I'm thinking of trees now. I want to read just a sentence or two from E.M. Forster about trees. This house is the main character of this novel, Howard's End. And there's a witch elm that's outside the house on the property. And Margaret, she sees the tree for the first time and she says, "It was English. And the witch elm that she saw from the window was an English tree. No report had prepared her for its peculiar glory. It was neither warrior, nor lover, nor god. In none of these roles do the English excel. It was a comrade, bending over the house, strength and adventure in its roots, but in its utmost fingers, tenderness and the girth that a dozen men could not have spanned." And she just talks about it, and she's calling it a comrade. And I was thinking, you know, there's a lot of mythology about trees. Yeah. And a lot of fairy tales about trees. And we're planting our two new plum trees soon this week. And we lost two trees last year in a storm. And I was thinking, this is part of why people write stories about trees. Because you look at a massive tree and you know that it's lifetimes older than you.
Yeah.
If the tree's big enough. And that is really crazy to acknowledge, that something has seen more time than you ever will. And then it points you to God, because he's seen it all.
Right. But
some of these trees are just so magnificent, and they're like these silent viewers of life.
Yeah.
And so they really do seem magical.
Yeah. And that's why I love, like, Tolkien, the Ents are my favorite in the whole book. It's my favorite. I know. And just talking about, like, oh, I've been here longer than all y'all, you know, like, I've seen it. I've been here before this age began, and like, whatever. And this is old news, you know.
They're like quiet old men who have just watched everything. And
I love their language, how they just like have these words, and they're like, our language is growing all the time. Like, we are, it keeps getting longer and longer and longer, you know.
I love it. It's like, so magical. Roots, like their branches. Yes.
Yeah.
I had one last question for you. Chesterton says that men worship naturally. And then he says, but prayer and sacrifice are a liberty and an enlargement. So he's sort of like building on that. And my question is, how do prayer and worship and sacrifice liberate us?
Yeah. I mean, my first instinct, I guess, would be to think about our natural inclination post-fall to be self-centered. And prayer and sacrifice and worship are things that necessarily, if we're doing them, I guess, correctly, take us out of ourselves to focus on something that is bigger and beyond us. It sort of, I think prayer and worship and sacrifice, all three of them, acknowledge that there's something greater than me that I can't do for myself, or I can't obtain for myself, or I don't know if that makes sense, but like reaching beyond ourselves for something more. What did you think about it?
I totally agree with everything you just said. And as you said the last thing, it made me think of what he says about, they think that by the imagination, they can, by some incantation of the imagination, draw up this truth that they're looking for. But prayer, worship, and sacrifice actually draw the real truth towards us, which is God. And it's like, not by our own power, but he gives us tools to access him and to love him. And you know, it's like, we're not only using the imagination anymore, which is like just the pure pagan worship and poetry and stories, but moving on to prayer and sacrifice to a specific purpose and to one God.
Yeah.
Not the gods anymore.
I think, I don't know, it just makes me think of Jesus saying, like, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. And recently our staff here has just been experiencing this, I don't know, springtime of like praise, where we realize that like I don't know, we've just been focusing a lot in our discussions of prayer and stuff about praise, and how one of the phrases that keeps getting repeated is like, praise foils the enemy, because the enemy is the father of lies, and praise, like true praise of God, like tells the truth. So It doesn't matter the like genre, I guess, of music, but you could be singing, like we sing the doxology a lot, like praise God from whom all blessings flow, you know. But when you're singing praise music, like true worship music, you're declaring truths about God. And when I was younger, I used to get a little bit annoyed because I'm like, these songs are so repetitive, you know, these praise and worship songs, you know, like they just keep saying the same things over and over again. Like, but that's the point, is like, I'm going to declare this truth, and that actually frees us from our selfishness. It takes us outside of ourselves. So one of the things we were talking about is how even in prayer, it can become just kind of like, it can kind of shift into this just like thinking about myself mode, where it's like not actually praying or not actually like a conversation, or it's just like a conversation
where
that's
you're just
one-sided.
Having time to reflect on whatever you want to think about.
Right. And that can get very like, self-focused and kind of stuck in our own selves. But praise is like a fix of that, because it's like, oh, if I'm just thinking about myself, it's like, oh, well, how can I focus on God? And so it's like, if I'm going to praise, specifically sing praise, it like takes, I don't know, more of your brain or something. I don't know. But it's like you're focusing your whole attention, just thinking, how it does kind of take you outside of yourself in a way that you're really, it's like, okay, if I'm going to sit here and I'm going to sing this praise song, it's all about God and it's nothing about me. I'm not thinking about myself. I'm not thinking about my stuff. I don't know how to fix my stuff, you know? And so it's actually surrendering that and being like, I'm not even going to try to think about it. I'm just going to put it in your hands, and I'm just going to sing all these praises. And then miraculously, like, stuff happens. Like, praise is powerful. Yes. And things get healed, and all kind of crazy things happen. So
so good. Well, we could keep talking about this chapter, I think, forever, but I think we should wrap it up
for sure.
Did you have any points of gratitude in this past week?
I'm just grateful for my mom to be in town. She hasn't gotten a chance. She's been taking care of my grandmother a lot, who's in her 90s, and so she hasn't been in town, I think, in like 2 years. So it's been fun to just like have her in town and to see my new place and everything, and see my friends and stuff. So
that's
grateful
awesome
for that. How about you?
I am really grateful for flowers and just everything growing around me right now. My neighbor gave me a bunch of peonies today.
I love peonies.
They're just perfect. They're like some are pink, some are this like dark red color, some are deep pink. Anyway, they're just beautiful, and now they're blooming on my table. And then my sister-in-law, like just within a little while of each other, my sister-in-law sent over these like most beautiful white roses for me.
I have giant white roses on my coffee table right now. And they're actually, speaking of, from Trader Joe's. And they're the most magnificent roses I've ever seen.
I'm just enjoying this spring so much. And I am happy about seeing all these trees around me, so I could understand this chapter a little bit better.
Totally. That's awesome.
Next time we're going to tackle chapter 6.
That's the demons and the philosophers, I think.
Yes, the demons and the philosophers. I'm posting this in all of our usual places, but you can send us an email at pintswithchesterton@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with us, or just go to the contact page at pintswithchesterton.com. May you all enjoy lives of wit
and whimsy. Cheers.